You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Robots are everywhere these days, in car factories, the military, the IRS. But while they can outlift, outstealth, and outcompute us, they lack our conscience, our sense of humor, and our ability to feel empathy. After all, they're machines. Sid Srinivasa, a professor at the Robotics Institute at Carnegie Mellon University, is part of a generation of scientists that argue that in order to do the jobs of our increasingly complex world, robots will eventually need to learn to be more like us. But some fear that that may come at a price. Professor Srinivasa's work is described in the August issue of National Geographic magazine on newsstands on July 26. It's called Us and Them, with photographs and text from photojournalist, writer, and filmmaker Max Aguilera-Helwig. And I'm very pleased to welcome both gentlemen to our show today. Hello.
Hi. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hey, Sid. This is Max.
There are lots of words for robots that look human. Android, humanoid, Blade Runner call them replicants. Sid, are you trying to build anything like that?
Yeah, well, I think we're trying to get robots out of the factory floors and into people's homes. And one of the things that's peculiar and interesting about people's homes is that it's full of people. So we're trying to build robots that can function efficiently in our homes. And so we really need to sort of rethink the way we build our robots. You can't take a factory robot and stick it into your home.
So you want to make it look human?
Well, I think we want to make it function in a human environment. And since human environments are sort of built for humans, it helps if it sort of looks more and more or behaves more like humans.
Max, what's it like taking pictures of robots? You don't have to encourage them to smile, do you?
One of the amazing things about you notice right away, it's like going to the movies or watching television. You suspend disbelief and interaction with a robot becomes almost immediate, and you start communicating with them. You watch, part of what I was doing was watching people do this. There's been a lot of tests doing this research, how people, humans, interact with robots, and I found myself, you know, immediately having a communication with them. What I think in that very similar way, the way we go to the movies.
We go to the movies, but not the way you would photograph a human.
Well, in a way, actually, I looked at, that's what I was working for, to find the humanness in these robots. That there are the androids and the humanoids. The androids are more like Data from Star Trek, and the humanoids more like C-3PO from Star Wars. But the androids' build is very much like human anatomy, and there's a function to that anatomy that works in both worlds.
What, Sid, does the robot called Actroid DER look like?
It looks very human-like, certainly. And, of course, you know, robots like my robot, Herb, also sort of, you know, have two arms and function. But I think one of the interesting things about humans, of course, is that we tend to humanize robots. You know, if you see a robot picking up a coffee mug, you tend to think, oh, that's cute. That's how I would pick up a coffee mug. So I think it's as much the robot's appearance as it is our own sort of internal monologue trying to humanize what we see in a robot.
And so we put two lights where eyes would be. We put receptors where our ears would be. We do that on purpose, don't we? It doesn't have to be built that way.
Yeah, and humans have this wonderful tendency to extrapolate, right? You see those lights and you think, oh, that surely that must be the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice in a way because it makes people comfortable to be around robots. And this is something that we want, right? We want someone like my grandmother to look at this robot and think that, oh, this is a robot that's going to help me. And it's just more comforting to them to see a human face or even something that might hint at a human appearance.
And they have been developing robots for the elderly, haven't they, like Paro?
Absolutely. And of course, our robot, Herb, that's being developed at Carnegie Mellon. Yeah, the focus is really on trying to enhance the quality of life of the elderly and the disabled.
So tell us about Herb. It's all in caps, so I'm assuming that's an acronym.
Yes, so the acronym is Home Exploring Robot Butler. So it's an acronym that one of my students came up with and sort of stuck.
Home Exploring?
Home Exploring, yes.
So it moves around the house and can actually knows where the closets are and where the dishwasher is?
Absolutely. It's a robot that, you know, it's a couple of arms on a Segway base, sort of just like the Segway that you and I ride on, but it's completely autonomous. So we can wheel Herb into your house, and he takes a little time sort of scanning the environment and figuring out where things are. And soon enough, he's able to do autonomous things in your house, like fetch you a glass of milk, open doors, move your wheelchair around if needed, really trying to enable autonomy and do it very seamlessly.
Other than the masculine name, what makes Herb a he?
I don't know. We sort of, I guess he's a little beefy, and he's a butler, and I guess most butlers are men. But I don't know, maybe this is a very subconscious thing if we look at Herb and sort of think he's a he.
Well, how different is what Herb is doing and what a robot that installs car doors does?
Well, I think the key difference between a factory and a home is that a factory is structured for a robot, whereas a home is structured for a human. So, you know, just like we would be very confused in a factory, a factory robot would be very confused in a home. So really, we're trying to enable robots like Herb to understand the clutter, the messiness of our homes, you know. And, you know, as much as my wife would like our home to look like a factory, it isn't. You know, I look at my desk right now in front of me, and it's piled with papers and coffee mugs. So nothing like a factory floor.
But Herb is just doing chores. Do you think he could ever be taught to do something like having a sense of humor or have real manners like a butler?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. Certainly, I mean, Herb is running algorithms. As long as we can develop algorithms for emotion and speech and butlerness, we would be able to incorporate them into Herb. But I think that's a very key point, is that it's not just about doing chores, but really about being appreciated and also being integrated into a home. And we're really working with artists and working with human-robot interaction people to try and look at the entire spectrum of what it takes to get a robot into a home.
Now, we have photographs of Herb taken by Max on our website and other photographs as well. And Max, let's talk about some of the things that you photographed. Can you tell us about the Entertainment Technology Center?
It's a school where they teach, you know, people how to design video games and all kinds of theatrical stuff, dealing in high tech stuff. And they had one of these Android robots from Japan there that was on loan to see if they could increase its dramatic character from a kind of banal character, and that's what we had gone to photograph and a team of students that were working on it.
So they want robots to learn to entertain us?
They can do anything along those lines. I mean, there are sex robots that are in development. In fact, when we were working on this project, it seemed like a natural thing to try and look to, because we're looking at humans and humans and robots. We're looking at the full spectrum of humans. But in the end, we actually couldn't find a successful sex robot. But
I'm not sure I know. A sex robot is a robot who...
An android that could interact, you know.
Well, that's in science fiction.
Well, they're leading researchers were telling us this is going to be the forefront of commercial robots in the next 5-10 years.
Well, why would we want robots to be totally autonomous? Isn't there a lot of science fiction about machines gaining autonomy and then destroying their creators, going all the way back to Frankenstein through HAL and a whole bunch of others?
For example, there on the forefront of this are the Singularity people, the Google people, and this foundation called Terrasim. They believe in Ray Kurzweil's idea of future, that in the future, the body, we will no longer need our corporal bodies. We will be, technology will overcome, and we will be machines. And
so a hybrid will be developed.
A hybrid or full machine. And so they are looking to a robot model for this purpose.
Sid, are you thinking along those lines?
Well, I think we're far away from any of that. And I also think that any technology can be used for good or for evil.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, we're developing core technologies. Right? We're trying to understand a lot of very fundamental questions. Also, I think it gives us a deep insight into how humans behave. Why do we pick up coffee mugs the way we do? Why do we rearrange the clutter in our house in a particular way? And so I think we're looking for insights, scientific insights, into how our own minds work so that we can get our robots to do it.
Although there are certain... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying that, well, the question of singularity, to me, it's far away. Every time I give a talk about robots, people ask me this question, when will robots take over the world? And I think if you're not a roboticist, it might be scary. But to me, as a roboticist, I see Herb and I think, it's going to be a while before Herb goes around taking over the world.
Well, first of all, it's hard to teach a robot how to walk, isn't it? I would imagine it would be really difficult to get a robot to do some of the things that I don't think twice about when I'm using my hands.
Absolutely. Yeah. Manipulation, you know, the ability to interact with the world is one of the most fascinating and frustrating things to teach a robot, right? Because humans do it so effortlessly. Every time I show a video of my robot picking up something in clutter to my grandmother, she says, well, the mug is right there. Why does the robot have to think so much? But, you know, really, this essence, this instinct that we have, humans have, of picking up stuff, it's a very hard challenge to try and transform and transfer some of that to robots.
Well, when you think 50 years into the future, what do you see as the future of robotics? Or is this something that's impossible to predict in the same way that it would have been impossible to predict an iPhone 50 years ago?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that no one really knows what the robot of the future will look like. And I think that's the wonderful thing about robotics, right? You know, you really have a pretty good idea of what a car 50 years from now will look like, but a robot could look like anything. People always ask me this, when will we see a robot like Herb in our homes? And I think the answer is that it's not like there'll be nothing for 50 years and suddenly there'll be this robot in your home doing your chores. I think the fundamental technologies that we're developing to enable a robot like Herb, you'll see appearing in your homes, in your appliances, in your fridge, in your dishwasher, long before you see a robot like Herb.
Now, Max, do you think that a robot could be taught to take a beautiful or compelling photograph?
They have developed advanced cameras that there's some camera that's been developed out in Silicon Valley that supposedly can take every picture imaginable given what's in front of it. So, you know, anything I think is possible. You know, if you look at what science fiction was like 10 years ago, and we don't have the time to go into everything that I saw and what's really going on, but the advances that are going on in the robot research and even in production are far more advanced than one realizes. We have robots among us. This is the navigation in our car. That's a robot.
I'm worried that it's not all that long before we're going to have robotic talk show hosts, although there may already be a few out there. But that's another matter. My guests are Max Aguilera-Helvig, who is a photojournalist, a writer, a filmmaker, co-author of an article in National Geographic magazine in the August issue, which hits the newsstands next week. Is it next week? The 26th. When is it?
Yeah, next week.
It's called Us and Them. And we're also talking with one of the scientists featured in the article, Sid Srinivasa, S-R-I-N-I-V-A-S-A, a professor at the Robotics Institute at Carnegie Mellon University. We'll take a little break and come back with more. We're back with Professor Sid Srinivasa, a professor of robotics at the Robotics Institute at Carnegie Mellon University. He's one of the people featured in an article in the August issue of National Geographic magazine, which is on newsstands on July 26th, called Us and Them. And with us is a man who provided the photographs and some of the text, photojournalist, writer, and filmmaker Max Aguilera-Helvig. Max, you were the outsider in this case, or had you already been long interested in robotics?
I'm an outsider, yeah.
So what stunned you the most about what's going on?
Well, actually, I actually had an initial encounter with a robot, and I didn't quite realize it. But when I started doing the initial research, I thought, oh, wow, this is what this is all about. Coming off of work one night, and I started interacting with the IKEA avatar, the little cartoon character that helps you go to the part of the website. You know, should I go to the living room or this part or that part? And instead of saying, you know, typing in the thing where she says, her name's Anna, where can I help you? Where do you want to go? I put in there, how many hours do you work? And she would come back and says, what part of the catalog do you want to go? And I said, do you work too? Are you working too long, or do you working too many hours? I kept asking these very real questions, you know, and you know, to the point where I was asking her, do you think you should take Prozac? And you know, do you have time off? Do you have vacation? Where about your family? Where you were born? And what everything about, but someone had programmed some very real answers. I really can't talk about that. And whatever, and what this is actually the essential root of common robot data bank language. It's a tree of answers that'll fall back, and you ask a question, and it'll go to that place if you say the right word, and where it's going. And I realized, oh my God, this is the beginning of navigation, and this is the basis of artificial intelligence.
So does robotics, Sid, begin with computer programming?
Oh, absolutely. I think just thinking back to why I was interested in robotics was when I read about this system back in the day when I was just starting my undergrad about Deep Blue beating Garry Kasparov. You know, here was a robot that was a computer program beating one of the smartest, best chess players in the world, and that really got me thinking about, you know, I want to build robots that can do all sorts of things, not just play chess.
Well, when they started building Watson, they realized that it was a lot harder to put other kinds of knowledge into a computer other than just all of the games and the history of the world that have been recorded, which is what they did with Blue. And Watson, they had to really learn how humans think, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And robots deal with absolutes, you know, just like what Max was saying. If you change the question that you're asking that IKEA bot, it gets confused because it needs to work with absolutes. Humans, you know, we tend to improvise, right? We are given a question that we sort of know the answer for, but we're able to generalize from previous experiences in a way that sort of seamlessly takes us into the answer for the new question. And getting a robot, Watson to improvise, I think, is a big challenge. It's the same thing for Herb, is that when he observes a new scene, a new kitchen in a new house, he needs to sort of improvise and think about, well, I've seen kitchens like this before, so, you know, the coffee mug ought to be here, right? And being able to generalize from previous experiences is something uniquely human that is quite a challenge to incorporate into a robot.
Well, you're building robots that will have a practical use as caretakers, chore doers, etc. But what does building robots teach you, if anything, about yourself and your own humanity that's not practical?
That's a very good question. I think I do tend to scrutinize myself a lot more these days. You know, when I'm making breakfast and I'm, you know, breaking an egg or picking up a coffee mug, I always wonder, like, is this the right way to do it? Is this how I would teach Herb how to do it? So it's almost like having a baby. You know, you sort of have to understand why you're doing something so that you can teach the baby or the robot how to do something.
Now, Max, can you tell us a bit about Actroid?
When we first saw Actroid, it was phenomenal to see this because it was so lifelike. But in essence, it's an animatronics-type experience. It's like Disneyland, the Lincoln, or these characters that you see. And the far reaches of Android is these very realistic, human-like skin and hair. There's a roboticist here in the United States named David Hansen who makes the best skin. And they're working on very unique ways to make...
David Hansen. Because Dwayne Hansen was a sculptor who also made very realistic-looking skin for his sculpture.
So the whole trick for us to... When I was talking to you before about suspending disbelief and get you involved in the experience of interacting with the robot is to and have that conversation. One of the things that Hansen does, he has crow's feet. He has developed a way to have that in the eyes so the eyes don't just remain flat. And actually, her eyes aren't that developed. He's found a way to do that, and it makes the believability just a bit more.
And it's a she.
He's developed several men and women.
Does it matter, Sid, when you're developing a robot, whether it's a male or a female?
Well, I think it's important to think about not just the function, you know, the algorithms, but also the form. And it's quite possible that certain forms are more agreeable than certain others. Right? I have a GPS unit that gives me instructions, and I always tune it to the female voice because I'm just so used to getting instructions from my wife that I just follow it blindly. So you know, there's a case where form is important.
Are either of you apprehensive about the future of robotics? You mentioned, Sid, earlier that everybody worries about when they're going to take over the world. But if our chores are taken, so many of the jobs that we normally do are taken away from us, something else does it for us. Don't we lose something in the process?
I don't think so. I mean, if you look at the computer, right, it's enabled us to do so many things, even though it's taken away from us the chore, the burden of computing. You know, we don't have to do it on pen and paper. Likewise, I see robots as a physical avatar of computing. It's just taking away from us certain physical chores that we don't have to do. And, you know, if I didn't have to do certain chores, I think that would just free up my time to be more creative, do more interesting things.
Although there's another side to that. There was a recent study that indicates that people aren't remembering as much about just the normal facts of life because they can Google them. So, and I know, I remember a time when I had probably 30 or 40 phone numbers in my memory. Now there are two or three I don't have to remember anymore. Now, maybe that's no great loss, but sometimes I need to remember that number and I can't.
Yeah. Well, you know, humans evolved, right? 200 years ago, maybe 500 years, maybe 10,000 years ago, people used to hunt. I can't hunt anymore. But I can do a lot more things now, right? So I think that just like, you know, everything evolves and you can't remember numbers now, but perhaps you can do a lot more things. You can search billions of text strings online and your knowledge is, I think, a lot more. So I think it's just a natural course of evolution.
I would think there's pros and cons. And we're finding, you know, there's a fine line in this whole bit to me. And I'm not afraid of technology in this whole thing. I think it's great. I think it's going to be a great robot world, and we have nothing to fear from them, either as soldiers. You know, people, when you talk about the robot soldiers and stuff like that, I think there's great advantages. And I'm way left and anti-war and everything. But if it's going to save a life and have robot in all that way, to be a soldier. But I think we lose something. I shoot film. I don't use a digital camera. And the loss of, they don't make my film anymore. And the reason why I like working with my camera is I like working with my camera. I like that hands thing. And 100 years from now, people won't know how to go in the darkroom anymore.
Also, there are photographers who have distinctive styles. You can look at a Salgado photograph and know immediately that it's by Salgado. I don't know whether digital photography allows for that kind of distinctive look.
It allows for a lot of variety, but there was more variety. There used to be 1,000 cameras. Now there's 10 cameras, and they all do the same thing.
My guests are Max Aguilera-Helwig, who is a photojournalist, writer, and filmmaker, and supplied the photos, and part of the text for an article called Us and Them, which is in the August issue of National Geographic magazine, which is on newsstands July 26th. With us also is one of the scientists featured in that article, Sid Srinivasa, a professor at the Robotics Institute at Carnegie Mellon University. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Can either of you tell us a bit about Masahiro Mori? You want to begin, Sid, or should we go to Max?
Max?
Yes. This is the fellow who came up with the idea of the uncanny valley, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And when I first, there's this concept called uncanny valley, and when I first heard about it, I said, oh, wow, I got to photograph this. When we start this, I got to find that and photograph this thing. But, and I'll explain what that is. It's something like a bell curve. And Sid kind of talked about it. I think you were talking about there, Sid. But in the more human-like a robot becomes, as you reach the top of the curve and we can communicate with more. We become, as a human, we become closer to it. But the less imperfect it is in its humanness, because it can never reach perfection, it starts going down the slope on the other side, and we get this uncanny feeling. And we feel uncomfortable. And the perfect example of this was when Polar Express, the super first high technical animated film with very human-like animation, came in. It supposedly had a very strange reaction to a lot of viewers and such. The thing is about this Uncanny Valley, there's a very strong, very strong feelings about it in the academic robot world, and you are supposed to be one side. You're supposed to make non-human looking robots. There's a definitive camp that way, but there are others like Ishiguro, like Hansen, who make very human looking robots, and there are very strong arguments about this that can be quite nasty. I found while I was working on this story. And when I started working on the story, all that Arizona stuff was coming out where they were, you know, if you got arrested and you happen to have brown skin, you might get deported, you know, if you found out you were undocumented. And that always reminded me of Nazi Germany and whatever. And what I came to think about similarly in this Uncanny Valley idea, you know, a robot is an inanimate object. It's just a machine. You know, that we would find, because people have discussed about this and fear. We fear this thing. Don't do that.
Blade Runner, this was a major the Blade part of
Runner,
the plot.
Yeah, Blade Runner. The thing is that it's just a machine. And, you know, that people would embody such strong feelings of disgust and whatever. It's just another unknown that we are going to put bad thoughts about. And
do you think that Ishiguro is as interested in human psychology as he is in developing robots?
He is, yeah. The people like him are very much interested in that.
Sid, are the fields of psychology and robotics merging?
I think so. I think that as we start committing to getting robots out of the factory floors and into people's homes, we have to really think about what the consequences of those are.
And what are your thoughts about this, HRI, for example?
Well, I think it's critical, right? One of the key features of a home is that it's populated with humans, and humans and robots will be interacting. We certainly want to think about how a robot can be integrated into a home seamlessly, right? You don't want to keep looking over your shoulder thinking, what is this robot up to? You want the robot's intentions to be clear, its function and form to be very clear. And I think this is a big shift in robotics, the fact that we're sort of committing to getting robots into human workspaces. And so we really need to think about the consequences of all of that.
Could you tell us about RoboV and the experiment he played a part in?
Well, I don't know much about RoboV myself, but I think we're really, one of the things is to get robots and humans sort of together and to see the reaction that humans have to them, right? Like the Uncanny Valley, for example, I think elicits an interesting reaction when people look at these robots that look very much like humans. And sometimes I feel like when I look at these robots that they're distracting me from their function. Like I'm staring at the form and thinking, why does this robot look so human yet not? And I'm distracted by that. And I think it's really important to think about how exactly you create the form so that its function is not distracted.
I would find that...
I'd be distracted by a robot that looked like Sean Young. Was that her name? The woman in Blade Runner?
I would say that's in the eye of the beholder. It's what you bring to the table on that, but that's my experience.
Do you think that a robot could ever learn to have a conscience? Is that a goal of yours, Sid?
Well, I think our goal is to enable robots to function safely and effectively in human environments. And I think that a lot of the functions that our robot performs are sort of, in some way, demonstrate a conscience. You know, it's trying to be safe. If it sees a person in front of it, it tries very hard to act in a particular way so that its intentions are very clear.
Well, Max mentioned the robot soldiers, and right now we have those drones that are in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I was wondering what if a robotic device accidentally blew up a hospital? Who would be to blame?
Yeah, I think this is a very critical issue, right? And I think, you know, as we change our paradigm to involve robots more with humans, we have to sort of rethink what that means and who takes responsibility and liability. If you have autonomous robotic cars driving around, it's not if they will have an accident, it is when they will have an accident. Because even the most perfect system will have an accident.
Because computers crash as well.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And so I guess it's a very interesting open question of what do you do when such an accident happens? Who takes blame? Is it the robot? Is it the programmer of the robot? I don't know.
You founded the Personal Robotics Lab. What's the lab's mission?
Well, our goal is to try and enable robots to perform useful tasks in the home, both for people and with people, with a real focus on the quality of life. You know, if I can produce a system that can enable an elderly or a disabled person to spend just a few more weeks, months being more independent without the need for a caregiver, I think that would be very, very fulfilling. So really getting robots to do useful things for people and making that, you know, seamless and effortless.
And Max, you've worked with Annie Leibovitz at Rolling Stone, photographed heart and eye surgery, archaeological digs, taken portraits, and now, of course, taking pictures of robots. Are you going to go back to human endeavors?
Well, very much so, yes. Yeah.
Meanwhile, people can see your photographs in the on a link that we have. So we actually have a little bit of a photo display, a sideshow on our website at wnyc.org. And then the magazine is coming out on July 26th, National Geographic, the August issue. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.